I'd like to open the message today by turning back to Exodus chapter 15, if you want to head back there, Exodus chapter 15. And as we're turning back there, I wanted to get a little bit of context as to what's happening here in our story for this fledgling nation of Israel. At this point in our story, they've just escaped Egypt, and God, through tremendous miracles and with a mighty hand, carried them, and sometimes dragged them, out of Egypt, out of slavery. On chapter 14, just a chapter earlier, we have the crossing of the Red Sea. That was an incredible miracle. Starting in chapter 15, we have the song of Moses, where everyone is singing. Things are looking brighter and brighter. I want to pick it up in verse 20 of Exodus chapter 15, just to get a little bit of the flavor here. Exodus 15, starting in verse 20. It says, "Then Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dances. And Miriam answered them, said, 'Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. And the horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea.'" We have a great hymn that we sing that echoes these words here. It's a great upbeat song. Starting, though, in verse 22, we start to get a few cracks in the enthusiasm, though. They come across an area that doesn't have any drinkable water, and that's a problem. You're going to need that. But it's just a test, as we know, and God delivers them yet again. The next chapter, though, to me, starts to feel like their situation is starting to hit a little closer to home now. They're over the high of the Red Sea, and now they're stretched out over the desert, and they're looking around, I'm sure, and they're thinking, I don't know if I'm super encouraged by what I see. Over on this side over here, they have sand. Then there's some rocks and some shrubbery and some more sand over here. And then over there, there's some more sand and sand over there and sand everywhere. There's just sand as far as they can see. I'm sure some of them are turning to their neighbors and thinking, what are we going to eat out here? Seems a little dire out here. Exodus chapter 16, verse 1. Exodus 16, verse 1. "And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt," verse 2, "and then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, 'Oh, that we had died by the hands of the Lord in the land of Egypt.'" Be careful what you wish for here. "When we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger." You know, we give the Israelites a lot of flack by how quickly they turned and they forgot all the amazing miracles that God had done for them. But it's amazing how that works for everyone, isn't it? And it's by no means limited to the ancient Israelites. How quickly can I turn from a blessing to the next day worrying about the future again? It's the same for all of us. And God, he answers this question by doing something absolutely amazing. Verse 4, still Exodus 16, now verse 4. It says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. The people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not.'" Dropping down to verse 14 now, same chapter. "And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, 'What is this? What is it?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer for each person according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent.' Then the children of Israel did so, and they gathered, some more, some less. So when they measured it in omers, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered according to each one's need." Finally, drop down to verse 31. "And the house of Israel called it manna. It was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So not only did God supernaturally deliver this food right to their doorsteps, they didn't even have to do anything for it other than to go out and collect it. And not only that, it tasted like wafers made with honey. Huh. That sounds pretty good to me. You know, the first day when they were walking out there, they had to be just absolutely shocked. That whole first week, I'm sure they looked at their neighbors and they're shaking their heads like, can you believe this? Everywhere, it's unbelievable. Day 37 comes and it's probably at that point started to become part of the routine now. Day 71, and it's just kind of what you do now. Just you go out, you collect it, it comes down, we eat it, it's great. Day 102, it's just kind of part of the land. We got sand, we got rocks, now we have this manna stuff. Day 328, and I bet it's lost a little bit of its luster by then. I mean, it's great. Don't get me wrong. I love it. The taste is great. I'm thankful. Day 514, and now you're secretly looking behind all the different rocks to see if there's anything but this manna out there to eat. But no, we're still thankful for it. Damn, love this manna. Day 790, manna again. Like, you got to be kidding me. Enough with the manna. I've got manna coming out my ears here. Day 1,462. Does God hate us? I mean, is he torturing us? Is this a joke? Is this all he has here? Just this manna? Day 3,004. I hate this stuff. I never really liked coriander to begin with. I think I'm allergic to honey. You know, when you reach day 3,000, they only had 11,000 more days left of manna. Just 11,000 more. Do you think after all that time, this bread from heaven, this incredible miracle, do you think it got to be a little stale? Just a little stale? Now I can empathize that something God has delivered as a miracle and as a blessing can sometimes slowly turn into something that we can take for granted at best, maybe even resent at worst. And as we start another year of these days of unleavened bread, how can we keep these same rituals, these same lessons, these same principles that we have from also getting just a little stale? For some of us, we've been keeping the Feast of Unleavened Bread for many years, and we go through a pretty similar process. In our family, every year is pretty much the same. A couple of weeks before Passover, we start to panic because we haven't de-leavened anything. Then Sarah will make a list and put it on the fridge, and we'll go through and we'll check it off. We kind of do the same things every year. We even buy the same things. They have these gluten-free matzos that we love. We rush out and buy them, and we just eat them like crazy. We buy a couple traditional boxes of matzos, and we throw those out a few weeks later, uneaten. We have a routine. We go down through our list. And for me, sometimes we can do some of these things on autopilot. It's what we always do. But anytime we take a ritual or tradition and we do it over and over and over again, it's possible to lose the impact of the meaning behind these days. So do these days of unleavened bread have the same impact to you as it did last year and the year before and your first year that you did it? How do we reinvigorate this week so that the principles that this holy day represent get equally revitalized in our hearts and in our minds? Well, I have 2 points for us to consider today. 2 points we can use to help keep these days from turning stale in our mouth. Point number one is to use mealtime as an opportunity to refresh spiritual relationships. Use mealtime as an opportunity to refresh spiritual relationships. And point number two, renew the why, not just the what, of unleavened bread. Renew the why, not just the what. And they're both important. They're both certainly important. Point number one is to use mealtime as an opportunity to refresh spiritual relationships. You know, thinking about this message, one aspect about how God has worked with mankind over time really jumped out at me. And it's, have you ever noticed how much of the Bible has to do with food? Has to do with food. And you might be a little skeptical about that, but I think you might be surprised. What do I mean by this? Well, the first recorded failure of mankind was what? Eating the wrong thing, eating the wrong tree. We have God that's dividing his creation into clean and unclean. We have Israelites that have a sacrificial system that is built around things that can be eaten. He even has instructions about sprinkling salt on those offerings. Very nuanced principles around food. God rescues the Israelites out of slavery after a Passover and a night to be meal. And he does that to take them into a land flowing with what? Milk and honey. We already read about manna here. They set up the tabernacle, and there's just a few things in it, including showbread. There's plenty more examples in the Old Testament. It continues right into the New Testament as well. Jesus Christ's first recorded miracle was turning water into wine. His very last miracle was sharing a meal with his disciples. And in between, we have the two biggest, feeding the 5,000 and feeding the 4,000. So on and so forth, all the way to the very end of the book. The last chapter of Revelation has a vision of a crystal clear river. And in the middle of that street, on either side of the river, is the tree of life, which bears fruit. More fruit metaphors. Food is everywhere, big and small, literal and metaphorically. And we understand this because as Christians, we are also supposed to grow fruit. All of this is kind of interesting to me because God doesn't actually need to eat. Doesn't actually need to eat. For a creator that doesn't need food himself, there sure is a lot to do in the Bible with eating and drinking and meals. And we're thinking about it extra much today on one of the two holy days that deals specifically with types of food. So why does God do this? Why is there so much about eating and drinking in the Bible? Let's turn back to Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2. We know just as a refresher in chapters 2 and 3. Let's go to chapter 3. But in chapters 2 and 3, we have letters written to the seven churches. Each of those churches have their own pros and cons, areas of improvements and whatnot. And we get to the last church here, which is the lukewarm church. And at the end of that, we get an interesting comment by Christ that says something that you might have glossed over before. We'll pick it up in Revelation chapter 3, now starting in verse 19. Revelation chapter 3, starting in verse 19, says, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore, be zealous and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. And if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him. And he with me." Eating meals is one of the deepest forms of human connection that we have. Even today, families, they bond over meals. Congregations come together around potlucks. Business arrangements happen over dinner, so on and so forth. Food engages the whole person. All of our senses are engaged, eating, of course, but it goes deeper than the superficial. Like when you're hit with a smell and it immediately triggers a memory or feeling that you had in the past. This activity of eating and sharing food together, it builds connections differently than almost any other thing that we do. So it only makes logical sense. How do you teach spiritual truth to physical beings? Well, you tie it to something that connects on many levels. Something that we need constantly, something that we interact with daily, and something that we cannot ignore, at least not for very long. But it's also something that it can be wonderfully enjoyable together. We all have foods that bring us joy and comfort that we want to share with one another. It's something very unique. Turn with me back to John chapter 21. John chapter 21. We reference this miracle, but let's see it in action. This is the last recorded miracle of Jesus. We'll say here that Jesus used a meal to really connect with his disciples. John 21, We'll start in verse 4. It said, when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples didn't know that it was Jesus. Not yet. And then Jesus said to them, children, have you had any food or have you caught any food? And they answered and said, no. Verse 9. Then as soon as they had come to land, this is after he taught them how to, or showed them how to catch fish supernaturally, they saw a fire of coals there and fish laid on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, come, bring some of the fish which you have just caught. Verse 12. And Jesus said to them, come and eat breakfast. Yet none of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? Now knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus then came and took bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. And then they ate. And Jesus was able to connect and have this strong, meaningful interaction with Simon Peter and the others. As we enter into the Feast of Unleavened Bread for another year, we have this awesome opportunity here. We have our same meal times that we have to do. But during these days, we're already thinking about them differently. We've already broken out of our normal routines. We're thinking about what we are eating more than normal. Our mealtime planning is already more deliberate. Now is the perfect time to carry that over in a more full way. You can use this mealtime as an opportunity to refresh spiritual relationships with one another and, of course, with God. This holy day isn't just about putting leavening out. It's a whole week-long-lived metaphor where we have the putting of unleavened bread in. And each day, each meal, we have an extra opportunity to reconnect with a spiritual principle. Like in our meal planning, we should be more deliberate in our conversation. We can focus on topics that edify and uplift. We can encourage one another. We can use this as an opportunity to just simply mention how much we love and enjoy each other's company, something we don't do nearly often enough. Just say that I love being with you. At your next mealtime, if you have trouble knowing where to start, think about Revelation chapter 7. Let's go there. At our next mealtime, we can start a discussion about the ultimate meal that we will have. Revelation 19, starting at verse 7. Revelation 19, verse 7 says, let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife, us, has made herself ready. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. And then he said to me, write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true sayings of God. This is a meal that will never get stale. Never get stale. Leads us right into our next point as well. Point number 2 is renew the why, not just the what, of the days of unleavened bread. And again, both parts are very important. I want to start by going back to Exodus chapter 13, if you want to head back there. Exodus chapter 13. I think you are required to read from Exodus 13 on the days of unleavened bread. We covered this last night during the night to be observed together as we read through it. We're going to pick it up in chapter 13 and starting in verse 4. It says, on this day you were going out in the month of Abib. So just we're jumping into the story here. The 10 plagues, they've already happened. Egypt, as the nation is in some sort of disrepair after all these disasters, and they want these Israelites out. Verse 5, and it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. And no unleavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. That's where we're at right now. Verse 8. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying this, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. And it shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. Now, what God does in these chapters and throughout so much of his interactions with the Israelites is to present his plan in multiple different ways. There's always the what. He's doing something for them right then and there. He's rescuing them. He's parting the Red Sea. He's doing the what. But then he takes time to explain the why, which also has to do a lot with what's happening right then and there, but also points to the future why. He does some action. Then he breaks it down, the why of it. And it's often, like I said, broken down into the part of right now, pointing also to what is happening in the future. There's that duality there between it. And we are in the middle of it right now, they might think. God has just rescued us. He's taken us out of slavery. The why right now is to get us to the promised land. But the why, the ultimate why, is to have a new relationship with this people that he calls his special treasure. We have the now and the future. And each holy day is structured in a similar way. We have this link between this proscriptive past, how we got to where we are right now, all the blessings, big and small, that God has done for us to get us to where we are right now, but also the proscriptive vision of where we want to be. They're so tightly blended together that we can't pull them apart. We shouldn't pull them apart. And too often the Israelites, they only focused on the past and they lost sight of that future, even as Jesus Christ was trying to reinforce this over and over and over and over again. Last year when I was preparing for the Holy Day message, I went through all of Exodus and I tried to find examples of where the Israelites themselves were happy to be going to the land of promise, the land of milk and honey. There's lots of instances when they're thankful for being saved for something. Lots of instances of them complaining about something. But it's very hard-pressed to find any examples where they themselves have this vision of where they are going. So much so that God has to keep reiterating it from them. It's not just about now. It's about where we're going. It's about where we're going. Exodus chapter 19. Starting in verse 3, this is God trying to keep this fresh in their minds. Exodus 19, verse 3. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him from that mountain, saying thus, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel." Verse 4 of Exodus 19. "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." That's where we're at right now. That's how we got here. "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant," then where are we pointing? "Then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." Now, God was clear that he wanted them to remember their past. Of course, that's the case. He wants them to remember the signs and the wonders and the mighty hand that brought them out of slavery. This is enshrined on all of our rituals and our traditions that we still do to this day. But God didn't just bring them out of slavery for its own sake. That was part of the plan, but that was certainly not only the plan. And as we go through the de-leavening process in our lives and eat unleavened bread this year, it's a great opportunity to also reflect on our own spiritual journey. God has done tremendous things for us in our past years, in our past life, to get us exactly where we are right now. But it's not exclusively just to get us where we are right now. It's the plan he has for us for the future. It's both. It's both. What he's done for us in the past and what he is doing for us in the future. It has to be both. Getting the spiritual leaven out of our lives, of course, that is a big part of why we're here. But that's not the only part why we are here. The vision of the future, the hope for tomorrow, in combination with also remembering what God has done for us, that keeps our relationship from growing stale. Get that spiritual leavening out. Fill up your spiritual stomach with righteousness, love, and compassion. Why do we do that? Revelation chapter 21. Just like for the Israelites, God also continually reinforces that vision for us. And here it is right here. This is a section of scripture we should read every year. Maybe every day, I don't know. Revelation 21, starting in verse 3. This is that vision of what it's about. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. And God himself will be with them and will be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." Verse 7, "He who overcomes," that's us, we that overcome, "shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son." We find ourselves getting a little stale in our relationship with God. Call back to mind all of these wonderful promises of the future in combination of all the things he has done for us in the past. They work in tandem to bring freshness to that relationship. Because just like the goal isn't to exclusively get rid of leaven, it's to build our character to be compatible with that wonderful family that God is creating so that we can be a part of it for all eternity. In conclusion, the days of unleavened bread are such a wonderfully unique holy day. God has designed such an ingenious way for us to stop what we are doing, to break out of our routine, and to give us the opportunity to focus more on him and his way of life. But at the same time, if we aren't careful, we can let ourselves go right on autopilot and not fully take advantage of this opportunity. After all, we see plenty of examples of this in the Bible, where people can witness an earth-shattering miracle only to have it kind of fade into the mundane in no time at all. But not us. Not this year. Let us capitalize on our mealtime as a way to refresh our relationships with one another and with our relationship with God. Let us keep the vision of why we are working to de-leaven our lives firmly planted in the forefront of our minds. And as we start these days of unleavened bread, let us work to maintain a fresh perspective and not let the meaning behind these days grow stale.